Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. What sorts of challenges are youth and families who are in some way connected to the child welfare system facing as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic? Shannon Moody can fill us in on this. Shannon is Senior Policy and Advocacy Director for Kentucky Youth Advocates. Thanks for joining us, Shannon.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And I understand that the issues and challenges that have emerged and continue to emerge as this pandemic drags on are many. And many, if not most, are complicated and complex. But I'd like to begin first with the basic challenges that the segment of the population we're talking about face right now. Can you give us an idea of the scope of those issues?
Yes. So when Kentucky Youth Advocates conducted focus groups and surveys to get a better handle on what issues the folks connected to the child welfare system are facing, what we found were emotional supports for both youth and caregivers are lacking. There's a lot of stress, frustration, isolation that people are dealing with during this time, I think like many. Also just tangible supports for caregivers, especially for our older caregivers or kinship caregivers who are grandparents or other relatives raising children. They especially struggled with some of the technology aspects of non-traditional instruction during school time, and also sometimes for that telehealth or teletherapy. Another issue that folks were seeing and feeling frustrated by was just a lack of communication from some of the systems that they interact with, whether it be from their social worker with Department for Community-Based Services, or sometimes from the courts if their virtual hearings were rescheduled. So there's some communications issues. And what we have been seeing prior to the pandemic as well is the child welfare system, in particular the Department for Community-Based Services, is really continuing to struggle with caseloads and managing the caseloads across the state. So there's still a clear need for budget investments to keep recruiting and retaining good quality social workers.
Well, one area that we're hearing about repeatedly that is just full of confusion and in some cases even chaos is school reopening.
Yeah.
What's happening? And the result of that is at-home schooling, two paycheck families needing child care and not able to find it. The difficulty with NTI, with non-traditional instruction, which is supposed to be very, very temporary, now it's not going to be for a lot of, especially rural counties. And so that's going to rely on technology and access to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
What are you finding in that area?
Some of the things that we heard in that area especially are, that transition, especially the immediate transition last year, was pretty abrupt. And folks didn't necessarily have access to Chromebooks or laptops, or the internet speed just was not making it accessible for the kids to join Google Classrooms or whatever, internet school sessions were happening. So there's a lot of frustration around that. Or there was sometimes, like I said, a lack of that equipment. But what we also know about the population of kids in the child welfare system, and in particular in foster care and kinship care, is oftentimes they're already educationally a bit behind, oftentimes because of that disruption of moving from placement to placement, or sometimes it has to do with the educational neglect that they experience. So in addition to access issues for internet or equipment, it was also the parents and caregivers who were trying to school their children in their home were finding it difficult to make sure that they could get their questions answered if they had questions about schoolwork. And the kids were often behind and really struggling as it was with the schoolwork anyways.
Foster care is a pretty delicate structure to begin with because we're talking about human beings here. We're talking about teenage human beings to boot. We're talking about older youth in that case.
And as I understand it, this situation has created quite a bit of instability in placements. Is that a correct assessment? And if so, what's going on?
Yes. So what we were hearing in that instability was especially strong for our older youth who've experienced foster care who were getting close to the age of aging out. So in Kentucky, we right now provide services to kids, or well, really young adults until the age of 21 if they choose to remain in care. And there were young people who were turning 21 as the pandemic was really hitting Kentucky and you know, the U.S. hard. And there was a lot of questions and concerns around, you know, could they stay in their apartment that was being provided to them with supports from the state, or could they stay in the programming that was provided to them? So there were kids who were either being told that they needed to leave because they were at that age, or there was a lot of uncertainty around whether they could stay because guidance hadn't come out immediately because, you know, there was a lot of kind of chaos at the time. So you had a lot of 18, 19, 20, and sometimes 21-year-olds who were not sure if they were going to be able to stay in the program where they are at because they were worried about losing access to that when they turned 21. What thankfully we did see is the Department for Community-Based Services issued some guidance around, you know, what foster care agencies who are providing those services to young people could provide. And they placed essentially like a moratorium on aging out up until, I believe it's been extended until September 30th. Hmm. So young people who've turned 21 between, you know, March and in this time now, they can remain in placement and remain in their the apartment homes or the services that they're accessing at least until September 30th. But then at that point, you know, we don't know if they're still going to have jobs available for those young people. And there's still quite a bit of uncertainty about what happens next.
This pandemic has cut off a lot of children from the routine day-to-day interactions with teachers and counselors and doctors, people in their lives who are required by law to report any signs of abuse or neglect. Are child welfare caseworkers able to go about their work under these conditions?
From my understanding, there were some parameters that were placed around what DCVS workers were able to do in order to make sure that they were maintaining the social distancing guidance. But it's my understanding that a lot of that has been lifted so that they are still able to go into the home and do those home visits, especially for some of those the really emergent issues or the issues that seem like really high stakes, so that they can still go into the home and do home visits. But it certainly for a while was, you know, really streamlined to only the most critical circumstances where they would be able to go into a home. And a lot of the alternatives were either making a phone call or doing a video call instead, which was not necessarily giving them a lot of the caseworkers had talked about still having some concerns because they weren't actually able to see the children in person.
Mm-hmm. But then again, physically visiting them is an issue, isn't it?
It is, yes. And like I said, my understanding is that there was guidance put out around when and how they were able to do that. And it was limited, but it continues to kind of open back up as things open back up as far as the social distancing guidance that's been put out. I don't think it's back to what was typical yet, but I think it has grown a bit since where we were back in March.
We're talking to Shannon Moody at Kentucky Youth Advocates. And Shannon, I wonder what you all are hearing from foster parents and kinship caregivers, other providers, about the challenges for youth in their care related to social isolation and loneliness. Are young people in their care showing more than the usual signs of things like anxiety and depression, despondence, anger, acting out, that kind of thing?
Yeah, based on what we heard, there were a lot of concerns from foster parents and kinship caregivers around how their kids of any age were coping with the isolation and lack of communicating with peers and seeing their peers and socializing and having kind of, you know, what you would identify as like a typical childhood experience. There were foster parents who said that their kids have just really turned inward and have been attached to their screens and have been displaying signs of irritability or anxiety around, you know, not knowing if they're going to be able to see their friends at school again or go spend time with people. And there was a lot of frustration as well because parks are closed, libraries were closed. And the typical things that you go do with your children or older adolescents, they're very limited because of the pandemic. And the foster parents and kinship caregivers were really struggling to figure out how to support their children while still maintaining the safety.
Well, the uncertainty of it certainly is the 900-pound gorilla in the room for this thing. We just don't know. And we don't know how long this is going to go on. We're all, I think most people are kind of pegging their hopes on a vaccine that could arrive in the, well, who knows? But in the meantime, since we're going to be going through this for a while, Shannon, what do you think needs to happen to help these children, these families, and all of the professionals who work with them get through this pandemic?
I think that's a fantastic question, and I appreciate it. And I think it's going to take, one, a lot of patience and a lot of understanding. I think we need to be really mindful about how we interact with our parents and caregivers and how we are supporting our parents and caregivers. And I think it's just checking in on parents and caregivers to just see how they're doing, you know, giving them an ear when they need it, lending a hand if they need help going to the store, you know, still practicing social distancing, but you can drop off a casserole on a porch. And then also, I think part of it is as a neighbor to neighbor, helping to support each other, but also on a systemic level, making sure that the communication is as clear and regular and frequent as possible from those systems that the families interact with. So from the school districts, from the Department for Community-Based Services around the different types of supports, from the courts, making sure that the communication is accessible, it's made very clear and easy to understand, or it's easy to find if somebody is looking on the internet for answers. So making sure that, you know, we're being transparent, we're being as clear as possible, but then also person to person, we're trying to give each other some grace and lend a hand where we can and look for ways to provide some respite for our foster parents and kinship caregivers whenever possible.
Shannon Moody, Senior Policy and Advocacy Director for Kentucky Youth Advocates. Thank you so much, Shannon.
Thanks so much.
Doing their best to prevent COVID-19 from interrupting the education and development of our children is foremost on the minds of parents and educators. Our series, Teaching in a Pandemic, continues with EKU's Tanya May.
Today we have joining us the superintendent of the Corbin Independent School System, Mr. David Cox. Superintendent Cox, thank you for being part of our series on reopening Kentucky schools.
Well, you're welcome, Tanya. Thank you for having us. We appreciate being here.
Would you begin today by telling us a little about the Corbin Independent School System?
Sure. We're grades preschool through grade 12. We have about 2,900 students in our district, located in the corner of southeastern Kentucky, about 20 miles from the Kentucky-Tennessee state line. We're about 70% free reduced lunch, high-performing district. We've been very blessed through the years to have good test scores, a lot of great teachers, and a lot of really good kids, and a very involved group of parents and a very active school board as well.
We all know that new information related to COVID-19 is being released, and things continue to change on a daily basis. And we know that all plans that districts have created remain fluid. But currently, is your district considering one or multiple reopening plans?
We've got one plan, but it encompasses three different options for parents, if you will. We went through this like everybody did when it first started, anticipating what may happen. And then as the rules change daily, and even the rules changing among the folks that are giving the guidance, and it's through no fault of their own, but we get conflicting information from the CDC, local health departments, and even KDE at times. And everybody's doing their very best, but it, depending on which expert you listen to, that all that information changes. So with that being said, our board along with our administrative team, sat down and came up with basically three options for parents beginning in the fall. We're going to start school on September 9th, which is 2 days after Labor Day. And with that, we were able to utilize the variable calendar, which is offered by Kentucky if you start later in August than normal. The three options would be fully virtual. Students would stay at home and get all of the content delivered virtually. And then we're also offering a 5-day in-person experience where students would just come to school on a regular schedule, just as if they would, as if there was no issues going on. And then the third is a hybrid, somewhat of a college schedule. And parents can opt into that for their child on a Monday, Wednesday, Tuesday, Thursday, alternating Friday schedule. And so parents can basically choose for their kids to be here all the time, what amounts to 50% of the time, or none of the time. But the thing that's made our reopening plan a little different and a little more challenging is that we have chosen to make an attempt to live stream all classes. So we're going to live stream at least the initial introduction and the direct instruction portion of the class. From every classroom in our district, about 180 teachers. Of course, they all wouldn't be on at the same time because some are on planning, but probably somewhere around 140 teachers live streaming at the same time to kids at home. So a student that opts for the virtual or the hybrid model would sit at home and they would log into their classes and participate with that teacher in real time as they're taking that class.
So what percentage would you say of your students have opted for full-time face-to-face instruction at this point?
We have done two different surveys, and interestingly enough, as the numbers for COVID issues have gotten worse, our numbers for in-person instruction have gotten better. We started out, the first survey we did was about a 70-30 split. Now, keep in mind, we did not offer the hybrid option during that time. That was our first initial go at this back in early July. That was about a 70-30 split. 70% of the folks wanted to be in school every day, 30% doing all virtual. Since we've offered that third option, that number has adjusted a bit. We've probably got about 40 to 43% of our kids wanting to come every day, and then another 30% or so doing the hybrid, and then the balance doing all virtual. So the hybrid has borrowed numbers from a significant amount of numbers from the folks who were going to go full time, but then a few from the other. So we're probably somewhere around 75% of our kids that are opting for some type of in-person school, with of that 75, about 43 to 44% coming every day.
Well, it sounds like a significant percentage will be coming at least some of the time for face-to-face instruction.
Yes, ma'am.
What type of accommodations will be provided for students who are choosing to continue with remote teaching and learning for those who may lack access to laptops or home computers or even internet access? What type of accommodations have or will your district be able to provide for those students?
Well, we utilized our CARES money, and we have never been a one-to-one district, but as far as letting students take them home personally, but we've pretty much been one-to-one or very close to that with use in school. We've invested a lot of money in technology. And we partner with Promise Neighborhood, who has been a tremendous partner as far as helping us purchase a lot of Chromebooks and technology throughout our district. Utilizing what we already had and also utilizing CARES money, we're going to be in a full one-to-one initiative, grades 3 through 12 this year. So every kid's going to have a Chromebook. And as far as access, our numbers say somewhere around 80 to 85% of the kids have high-speed internet access. We tend to think it might be a touch higher than that, but whatever that number is, we've allocated some resources to create hotspots at all of our schools so kids can pull up in the parking lot if they don't have access at home. If they can get to our parking lot once a week, then they can. We'll give them their Chromebook as well as a flash drive, and they'll be able to download whatever their lessons are just by accessing their student account from the parking lot. And then of course those that don't, then we'll utilize our school resource officers, who we won't need if we're totally virtual, and we'll utilize our youth service center folks to deliver some of those materials as well. We just don't know exactly what those numbers are yet, but we've got some contingency plans in order to do that. But the biggest thing, to answer your question a little more succinctly, we'll be in a one-to-one initiative, grades 3 through 12, and then we're reconfiguring hotspots on our campuses for kids to get to.
many may think that being a smaller independent school district, maybe there are less challenges than for larger districts. Would you agree with that? Or do you also think there are unique challenges that smaller or independent districts face during such a time as this?
You know, the only thing, I really couldn't speak to the smaller because we're the sixth largest independent district in the state. We've got, you know, nearly 3,000 kids. So our neighbors who are around us, who are all county schools, are all good partners with us. We share resources. Myself and their superintendents and our staffs meet a lot. I would think that possibly if you're a little smaller or you're an independent district, perhaps you wouldn't have access to some of the grants that are out there. To be honest, we try to just do the best with what we have. And we've been very fortunate. We've got a really good finance officer. We manage our money pretty well. And the CARES money has been an additional boost.
What do you feel like is maybe the most important leadership lesson that you've learned during this pandemic and that you feel has made you a better superintendent and will actually make your district stronger going forward?
Well, yeah, I don't know if it's made me a better superintendent or not, but it's certainly reiterated in my mind that you have to be flexible. Things change all the time. And, you know, Mr. McNeil was our former superintendent and my mentor. He was here for 24 and a half years. He was the longest sitting superintendent in the state when he retired. And the one thing I took from him more than anything was he used to tell me all the time, he would say, Dave, things usually aren't as bad nor as good as they seem. So it seems like the ebb and flow of this entire issue has taught me to be flexible. And I think that our staff has been so as well. And I think the one thing that might do for me as far as hiring people, that flexibility has certainly crept up the priority ladder for me as far as hiring folks. The people that have been the most advantageous to work with or the most important folks in our district have been the ones who've been really flexible and are, you know, idea starters. And so I think for me, that's what I've kind of learned.
Can you tell us what concerns you most for the 2021 school year?
The health of our staff and students, without question. I mean, you know, the biggest thing that we used to worry about from a school safety standpoint were violent acts. Well, this is not a violent act. These are things that can happen completely inadvertently, and it can be in the most innocent of circumstances. And so those things worry me because you don't really have control over that. You can't buy enough SROs to keep this out of your school. That really concerns me. And then from a more, I guess, pragmatic standpoint, the technology for all students is a bit of an issue. I don't mean that by a device standpoint. I mean just being able to utilize software and the training that it's going to take for our kids to be able to access everything that we're going to offer. And it's going to be a learning process for us. I received a call the other day, and it was one of the surveys from one of our senators. And my answer to them was, it always seemed like the same thing, but we need extra hands on deck. So any kind of money that could be utilized for salaries, at least in the interim, short term, bus monitors, lunch monitors, extra technology people. You know, when you put a device in every kid's hands, there's going to be more maintenance involved. We're trying to do it with a four-person staff. So we need twice that. So certainly those kind of resources. But, you could probably ask every superintendent in the state and they would have very similar lists.
Yes. Well, it's very encouraging that Corbin Independent, as well as school districts across the state, are continuing to put students at the center of all decision-making, and especially during this time of unique challenge. But we certainly wish you all the best in the upcoming year, and we thank you once again for joining us today.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Some facts and figures to consider about the teaching profession and the future of education. They come to us from the Center for American Progress, an independent, nonpartisan policy organization in Washington. Since 2010, total enrollment nationwide in teacher preparation programs has declined by more than one-third. This means that across the country, approximately 340,000 fewer students enrolled in teacher preparation programs in the 2016-17 academic year, the latest year for which data are available, compared with the number of students who enrolled in 2008-09. Similarly, there was a 28% decline in the number of students completing teacher preparation programs in the same years. Why is this happening? Well, for the first time in years, the report says, a majority of parents surveyed in 2018 said they do not want their children to become teachers due to low salaries, difficult working conditions, and a lack of career pathway opportunities. The teaching profession as a whole can't compare with other high-status professions like medicine or law. Even as teacher wages stagnate and state investment in education declines, teachers were being asked to do more than ever before the coronavirus pandemic added unpredictability and great uncertainty to the task. Coming up after the break,
our community of writers that is involved in this conference is national, and we're always looking to grow that community, and this gives us an opportunity to do that.
The Kentucky Women Writers Conference takes to Zoom for this year of pandemic workarounds. And getting comfortable with the discomfort of difficult conversations around race.
For some folks, this is super uncomfortable because they've never had to think about it before. I also tell folks discomfort is not a cause of death.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The Kentucky Women Writers Conference is happening this year, September 10th through the 13th, and in the way that many conferences are going forward these days, as a virtual gathering. And here with details is Randy Ewing. She's president of the board of directors of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference. Thanks for joining us, Randy.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And first, tell us something, if you would, about the Kentucky Women Writers community out there. Do we have a lot of good writers?
Kentucky has a ton of good writers. We have a long, strong tradition of writing in the state. And the conference itself, the Kentucky Women Writers Conference community, has a long tradition of having women writers join us from all over the United States. So the Kentucky in our name has to do with where the conference takes place. Many of the writers come from here, but many of them also come from all over. So it's an exciting way to make the community more inclusive.
Well, Randy, someday we'll all gather in person and share our stories about what happened the moment, probably late March, early April, when we realized that the big event we'd put so much time and effort into planning and arranging just couldn't happen, not at least in person. And I'm just wondering, how did that realization play out for the Kentucky Women Writers Conference?
Well, right, exactly. In a way, very much like that. We were in a meeting in April and started to decide if we were going to put it off or wait and see. And we decided that we wanted to avoid the decision fatigue that we imagined people would be feeling after a few months of a shutdown and just go ahead and make the decision now so that people would know that we were going to be having the conference and that we were going to be online. And that would give us time to plan for it, to make sure that we were able to have the writers there that we had invited. And we wouldn't be kind of wishy-washy back and forth. And as it turns out, this is a time where there's a lot of up in the air. So it's been nice to know that what we were doing for a while now.
So you have managed to move it online. And I'm wondering, have most of your featured speakers stuck with you? Did they make that move with you?
They have, yeah. Of course, this is the first time the Kentucky Women Writers Conference has ever been online. But it's also at a time where everyone is getting a crash course in that. So many of the presenters that we had already invited were learning along with everybody else how to do Zoom meets and online readings and those types of things. And they were able to make that transition with us fairly seamlessly.
This will be in kind of a Zoom format?
It will be in a Zoom format. We'll be hosted by the University of Kentucky Arts and Sciences Zoom platform. So we'll have links to all the events. Most of the plenary events will be in a webinar format, but we'll also still be able to have those small workshops that we have every year, about 12 participants and one of our featured writers. And then we'll still be able to have our free events, which will be much larger and in a webinar format as well.
And so you'll be able to capture these. Will these presentations then be archived and later available on demand?
We're hoping to be able to have them archived. We're looking at that has to be stored, so we're looking at our server space. But we're hoping to be able to have them archived and available at least for a period of time for people who've registered, so that you know, one of the great things about online is that if you can't be there right in the moment, there's often the opportunity to still see something and not miss out. And that's what we're hoping for.
Well, tell us about some of the presenters. Who are the highlight speakers?
It's really difficult. We have such a great lineup. And so anybody I don't mention would also be a highlight, but we're really excited to have our keynote speaker this year is Pulitzer Prize nominated poet Evie Shockley. She is the winner of the 2019 Lannan Literary Award in Poetry. And she has several books of poetry, a great presenter and a great poet. We have fiction writers that include Jamie Attenberg, who has several novels, is a very popular writer and has done for the last few years a really great online kind of writing support group where people will write 1,000 words a day for about 14 days. And this started off as a small thing that she was doing just to kind of get herself going and has turned into something of a movement, really, where people are doing these 1,000 words a day. So we'll have Jamie with us, as well as short story writer and kind of master Amy Hempel. Among our other writers, we have two nonfiction or memoirists who are also novelists. Bridgette M. Davis, who has written a story about her mother working in Detroit and running numbers in an illegal lottery and how that affected her childhood and how her mother was able to provide for her family there in Detroit. And Darcy Steinke, who's a novelist who's written a memoir on menopause called Hot Flash Diary. So we're really excited to have them and so many others, including our readers, and our writers from Kentucky, who are based in Kentucky. They're going to be featured in our Stars of the Commonwealth program. And those include Carrie Green, who's a poet, young adult author Mariama Lockington, and author Claudia Love Mayer. So we have a great lineup, and there's more even than those.
Well, talk to us for a moment, Randy, about why budding writers, women who are either considering a book, have not yet been published, but they're really thinking about it, or maybe even in the early stages of writing one, why should they attend this conference?
One of the great things about this conference is it is good for writers at any stage in their career, and we get writers at any stage in their career. And I'm using career really loosely because I believe anybody who's trying to write something is at the beginning of that career. And because so many different types of people attend, then you're also getting the opportunity to have conversations with people at different stages, with people who are in different, working in different genres. We're not only fiction or poetry. We mix those genres together. And so our sessions are available to anybody who registers. And often, you know, something in a poetry session will spark an idea for a fiction writer. So I think it's a real opportunity for conversation and connection and inspiration. And really more than anything, most writing is done, is a solitary pursuit. And this is a moment where writers can pause and come together and see that people, that you're not crazy, right? That other women are trying to write these stories or trying to capture some image and having the opportunity to talk with someone. And we're going to offer a space where we would normally have a table to go get a cup of coffee and talk with people and get to know people. We're going to offer a space on the platform where that we'll be able to recreate that to the best of our ability.
Yeah, and I know that you're also offering some community events, four of them, free community events, one on each night of the conference weekend. How is that going to work, and what's the agenda?
We are offering our four normal community events that are free and open to the public. You will need to register. People interested need to register for those events so that they can be sent the Zoom link, but there will be no charge. The first will be on Thursday, the 10th of September, and that will be from 7 to 8:30. And that's our keynote with Evie Shockley, a poet. She'll give a talk, craft talk, and also do a reading. The second will be on Friday. And this is a little bit of different of a lineup. We've moved things around a little bit. So our Sonia Sanchez series will be on Friday night, and that's going to be a viewing party. So one of the things that the online platform allows us to do is have some flexibility and try some new things. Sonia Sanchez is a very well-known poet and activist, and there's a documentary on her. And so we are going to be doing a viewing party of that documentary where people will be able to engage and comment in the chat, and then there'll be some special guests, hopefully, on either end of that. Then on Saturday evening, we'll have the Wild Women of Poetry Showcase. This is a slam poetry showcase, and this year we're going to make it non-competitive. We are looking to just kind of lift up these women's voices and their performances. And so this will just be a really good positive time where we can hear some great slam poetry and just kind of engage people as much as possible. And finally, Sunday evening at 7 to 8:30. So these are all from 7 to 8:30. We'll have our Stars of the Commonwealth reading. And that's where we invite writers who are based and living in Kentucky to share their work. And we have three featured presenters that evening: Carrie Green, Mariama Lockington, and Claudia Lovemare.
And you mentioned registering, and I wanted to make sure that we covered that base. Where do you go online to do that?
So you'll need to go to womenwriters.as.uky.edu. So that's womenwriters.as.uky.edu. And there will be instructions for how to register and how to get those links to, if you want to register for the conference. We have a reduced rate this year. We're hoping to make this conference as accessible as possible, reach as many people as we can. So we've reduced our conference registration rate by more than half. And then you can also sign up for a workshop there. That's an additional charge, or register for any of the free events so that you can be sent a link and be good to go to join us in those events.
Well, I guess if there's one good thing that can be said for going through a pandemic, it's that it's a learning process. And I'm wondering, has this process of moving the conference to an online format resulted in ideas that you might keep in place for the long term?
I think so. I mean, I think we'll definitely be able to see once we've done it what worked and what didn't. But already we're getting a lot of interest. We've had a lot of people go ahead and register. And we're hoping then to reach people who wouldn't normally be able to make the trip to be at the in-person conference. Like I said at the beginning, our community of writers that is involved in this conference is national, and we're always looking to grow that community. And this gives us an opportunity to do that. So I think, you know, that maybe that we have a hybrid conference at some point in the future that's allowing some of these things to be recorded and archived. We'll get better at doing that and just make all of these women's words and inspiration kind of more accessible to people.
Randa Ewing is president of the board of directors of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference. Thanks so much, Randy.
Thank you.
Future Tense is another of our 9 interview series here on Eastern Standard. Anthropologist and author Chris Begley hosts, with a focus on our future in a post-pandemic world. This series features conversations between Begley and guests, talking about where we are, where we are going, what we have learned, and sometimes even what it all means. In this installment, summoning the courage to have a conversation about racism.
Well, today on Future Tense, we have Carol Taylor Shim. She's the director of Bias Incident Support Services at the University of Kentucky. Welcome to the show, Carol, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. I'm really excited to be here and have this conversation.
Well, me too. And I wanted to see if you'd start by telling us a little bit about your work at the Bias Incident Support Services there at University of Kentucky.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the purpose of our office is to really provide confidential support and advocacy for any student, staff, or faculty member at the University of Kentucky who has had some sort of experience where they felt that an identity that they hold was targeted, and that could have been an actual identity or a perceived identity. And so some of the things people experience is around language, words that people use. There's a lot of microaggressions. There are a host of sorts of things that make people who hold marginalized identities feel as though either they shouldn't be there or that they're not wanted there. Those kinds of things happen more frequently than what people realize. And it's important, especially at the university, we've made the commitment to making sure that we have those support services for folks who have been impacted. It's all confidential, so we aren't mandatory reporters about anything. But we are the unit at the institution that is really charged with providing that level of advocacy and support. And so it's a lot of validating what people have experienced, helping people navigate through reporting systems, and also providing support as people are going through an investigative phase, however we can best support someone and help them heal from whatever injury that they have had, that is what we are really set up to do.
Okay. And when you do that kind of stuff, you're responding to particular incidents involving individuals. But I know that you also do training and perhaps other kind of work that deals with these sort of larger systemic or structural elements as well.
Yeah. So there are two of us in the office. It's myself as a director, and then Brandon Colbert is our coordinator for social justice, education, and engagement. And he typically works more with student populations, and so he does a lot of programming with different student orgs. He does work with SGA. His focus is really on helping students really grow in their own identities and helping them really unpack all the information that they've been taught about race and difference and privilege and who's worthy of being somewhere and who should be elsewhere. My role is very similar to that, but my work and my training is typically on a more university-wide kind of thing or with different departments, different administrative units of the institution. We are happy to provide whatever training and education that an organization feels like they need. We tailor our things specifically to the particular office or the audience. Not everybody wants the same sort of thing. Which makes it really nice for us because it gives us a wide range of topics that we can work with people on.
And the last 4 or 5 months, of course, for you will have been significantly different than any time before.
Correct.
Now,
very different.
Let me ask about this. Right now, we're in this moment of profound change. We have the pandemic, of course. The protests and other demands for change, for reform, social justice. I was interested in how all of this together, this moment in time, intersects with the work that you've been doing there and the kinds of issues and topics that you address.
Sure. One of the things that when I think about how COVID-19 and this particular global pandemic that none of us have ever experienced before, how that intersects with issues around race and racism and privilege and who has access and who does not have access. I always think about custodial staff. And if you think about, let's say you go to the hospital and, you know, you see people who are cleaning rooms, who are cleaning hallways, you see those folks. Overwhelmingly, those folks tend to be Black, Indigenous people of color. Not all, not 100%, but a vast majority of those folks are. When you add in COVID-19 and how disproportionately impacts Black and Brown communities, I always think about custodial staff because those are the folks that we are expecting to clean up the spaces where folks who have been positive have been. And so that increases the risk for the custodial staff who identifies either Black, Indigenous, person of color, because the rates are higher.
One of the things that we've heard a lot of talk about are, you know, essential workers. And, you mm-hmm. know, another thing is sort of the hidden labor that goes
yes.
into all of this stuff that we do. That sounds like that's certainly the kind of thing you're talking about there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I really like that term, hidden labor. Because when we are in spaces and we're, you know, in our normal work days, how often are we really paying attention to who's cleaning the spaces that we're in? Who's emptying trash? Who is mopping floors? And a lot of times we just kind of look past those folks. But when we think about who's at the greatest risk or a group of folks who's at great risk, custodial staff absolutely fall in that group for me. And if you are a person of color who is also working in this field, the rates and the risk are just astronomical, absolutely astronomical.
Yeah.
But if you think about why, we need to question why are custodial staff overwhelmingly people of color?
Yeah, and that really comes to sort of the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is in the last 4 months or so, there's been lots of things about ourselves that have been revealed in ways that maybe they weren't before. Now, some people, of course, have been talking about and dealing with these issues forever. But for other parts of the population, it's new to think about the ways in which things are unfair or unequal or divided up in these ways that we've taken for granted. For you, when you look at what we've learned about ourselves in the last 4 months, what stands out?
I think for me, what has been the most impactful and the most interesting to watch is an awakening with people who identify as white. People of color, Black people in particular, have always known and always felt institutional and structural racism. People of color have always felt institutional and structural racism. Indigenous people have always experienced it. We know it, we live it, we see it, we survive it. But now that white people are starting to recognize that there are enormous disparities across the board. In any system that you look at, people of color, Black people in particular, tend to be at the bottom. People, white people in particular, are starting to go, wait a minute, why is that?
And do you think that realization can lead to something? Where do you see us going in the future?
That's a great question. And I tell folks all the time, I have an enormous amount of hope for what we can get done in this particular moment. We are in a very, very unique part of our history. And it's really a turning point for us as a nation. And we have, I think, two choices to make. One, we can continue to ignore all the things that we know are happening, and we can continue to establish whiteness and white people as the group who benefits the most. Or we can all recognize and make a commitment to doing really, really hard work to understand why that is and to understand how we can dismantle it so that people, no matter their identities, actual or perceived, have access to the things that they need to live out this American dream. What is going on right now, as people are recognizing, there are huge barriers to access that will keep other folks or particular groups of folks marginalized and minoritized and will continue to elevate other groups. Whether that is a deserved elevation or not, we have to dismantle how we see each other and how we understand race.
And do you think this provides us an opportunity to do that then? In the midst of all of the negative elements, unemployment and, of course, sickness and death that goes along with the pandemic, there's this element of hopefulness, you say?
I think... one of the things that COVID-19 highlighted in such a enlightening way for folks was health disparities based on race. And so as people started to understand, there are certain groups of people who are at greater risk because of their race. When Black people are dying at greater rates from this disease than other folks are, people take notice of that. And so I do think that, again, there is this awakening for folks. People are recognizing how disproportionate treatment has impacted not only Black people, but it is starting to show itself in a host of different communities in ways that I think a lot of people have not even noticed. And so is it a turning point for us? It is absolutely a turning point for us. Can we make some progress? We absolutely can. And I think we have in a lot of ways. Progress looks different to people. So progress for one family might mean that at the dinner table, they're having way more conversations about race. And they are talking about, well, here's what I don't understand. Well, here's what I do understand. Well, maybe we should do these kinds of things. There's much more engagement in those kinds of conversations. That is progress. It's absolute progress. Organizations are really starting to take a look at how they have handled and or mishandled people of color. That is important as well.
Well, let's hope that this progress results in some tangible, you know, effects for everybody.
That is my hope as well. But I also recognize that we are trying to dismantle a system that has been put in place and has worked really well for some people for 400 plus years. And so it is going to take a significant amount of time to chip away at that. But what I also tell people is if we never start, we will never, ever have an impact. And so I'm all for people coming into the work, people getting on their own journey about how they understand things. I appreciate that. I think that is exactly what we need. For some folks, this is super uncomfortable because they've never had to think about it before. I also tell folks discomfort is not a cause of death. Like, people will be okay if they're uncomfortable. And we never change anything when we are comfortable. Change is born from a certain level of discomfort. And so I see people uncomfortable about what is going on and having these conversations, and I see those as opportunities. And so that is what keeps me really, really, really hopeful.
Carol Taylor Shim, Director of Bias Incident Support Services at University of Kentucky, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I enjoyed our talk.
One final note. It turns out that there was an Eastern Kentucky connection with that new Senate Intelligence Committee report on Russian interference in U.S. elections. As Sidney Bowles reports, it raises new questions about a beleaguered economic development project in Ashland.
The document is the most explicit acknowledgement to date that Russian aluminum firm Rusal and its associated companies are, quote, proxies for the Kremlin, including for Russian government interference efforts. According to the report, Rusal head Oleg Deripaska is a close associate of Vladimir Putin and was involved in the country's efforts to interfere in the 2016 election. Rusal raised eyebrows in 2019 when it announced a $200 million investment in the Ashland, Kentucky Brady Atlas aluminum plant, which had previously been struggling to attract funding. Rusal was able to make that investment because the Senate, with the encouragement of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, earlier defeated a measure that would have kept in place sanctions against Rusal. Senator McConnell stood behind the new intelligence report at an appearance in Hazard, Kentucky this week.
The Senate Intelligence Committee report is bipartisan and, you know, pretty much free of the partisan instincts that are going on in Washington.
Brady Industries has undergone a leadership transition recently and, in part due to the Rusal investment, expects to be up and running within 3 years. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sidney Bowles.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.